Melchizedek. We're introduced to his name back in chapter 5 and verse 6. He is named in chapter 5 twice. That is, he was found in 5:6 and 5:10. And let me just go ahead and review where we were and read from those verses. And you already know I'm not very happy with these Hebrews, because I'd like to know a whole lot more about it. And so in 5:6 it says, I'm looking at the wrong verses, not finding Melchizedek. And he saith also in another place, thou art a priest, talking of Christ, after the order of Melchizedek. This is a citation from Psalm 110. Thou, that is Christ, is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. He became a priest of the order of Melchizedek at his baptism or immersion by John at the beginning of his earthly ministry. And we talked about that. We're just building up. He was a priest. He became a high priest, and we saw that last week. He became a high priest when he ascended and was seated. And you have that grammatical reason for that. And we'll look at it quickly as we get there in a moment. Then in verse 10 of chapter 5, it says, called of God and high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And we talked about that and touched on that, how in his session, we were more into chapter 6 and verse 20. And that's what we need to read next. It says, whither or where the forerunner is for us entered in, even Jesus, made an high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Now remember, this made a high priest is a participle that ties to this main verb. In other words, it's the same time. They're both aorist participles. I mean, both, one's a main verb and one's a participle. And so this took place at one point in time. He was made a high priest when he entered in. So we talked about that. It tells us, so he became a high priest as a result of his final ascension. And so he was there. And so we get Melchizedek. Now, like I say, I get a little frustrated because of the problems that existed with the Hebrews, because Paul has to say, I can't tell you some things about Melchizedek because you can't, you're dull of hearing, you're deaf, you're nearly dumb spiritually. You should be able to handle it, but you can't even handle ABCs. You haven't had an exposure to the alphabet even, the first principles, the elements. And so he's going to give them a little bit, but there's a lot more, I'm sure. And we will know the intricacies of it if the Lord was to come back today or whenever he comes back. We will learn some of the intricacies of that and how special the order of Melchizedek is and our involvement in it. It's kind of interesting. You technically cannot be a member of both orders, because Aaronic was Old Testament. If you were the tribe of Aaron, you ceased to have your Jewish relations. Remember, there are three different races: Jews, Gentiles, and Church of God. If you're in the Church of God, you can't be a Jew. If you're not a Jew, you can't be in of the tribe of Aaron, even though you may have been born to that tribe or that part family of Aaron. And so, there are those who teach that you can be in both priesthoods, because they don't see any difference between law and grace in that matter. So, it's really interesting, because this is such an important realm for our understanding, this order of Melchizedek. The order. Depending on your background, when you read the word order, you will have different reactions to order. If you have been, churched in a sense, or well-read in some literature, you will think of priestly orders in the Roman Church. And so you have the Benedictines, you have the Jesuits, you have the Dominicans, and so on and so forth. There are so many orders among the Romanists, and I still smile because I never expected to be exposed to the Dominican order like I was. I had a boss who attended one of the few Dominican churches in the world. Dominican order is a teaching order. And he was on the parish council. I had the opportunity to, when Vatican II had been completed, he was in the first parish council and he was the president of it. And I was an advisory council to the priest. And so he would come and talk to me all week about things they needed to deal with or things to recommend. And he had a lot of contributions and I just about died. It was so funny because he was going to his parish council suggesting certain kinds of things that were a little bit more biblical and baptistic than most of them wanted to know. And I always smiled because I always had a passage of scripture to stir him up. And it was good in that. I would like to think he's with the Lord, but I can't say yes. Now, and you've heard that in my stories there in that matter. This thing of order and the importance of Melchizedek and these titles related to Christ. And let's just make it up front really clean so we understand this. Again, we've said it many times. Christ was born of the tribe of Judah. He was of the lineage of David. He was the one person of the lineage of David at the time that he was born that was qualified to be the king, and he was the last one. You have problems with genealogy there, and he was the one who could have taken the Davidic throne at that time, and he will be over the Davidic throne in the millennial kingdom. He was born of the tribe of Judah, the royal tribe. He was not born of the tribe of Levi. That is the tribe in which Aaron was born, and Aaron was the high priest, and his sons were the priests. So Christ did not qualify to be an Aaronic priest. I look at it and I smile. Because as a Melchizedekian priest, he was able to take his own blood and put it on the altar in heaven. He could do that. Aaron couldn't have gotten out of atmosphere earth when it worked. But Christ could do it. And we haven't gotten to that section of Hebrews because it's pretty clear in that matter. And so Christ is of the tribe of Judah. He could not be a priest of the order of Melchizedek, but God designed it so that there would be a separate order free from the law. Free from the law. You're used to me doing what I do sometimes because I don't read the word perfection in verse 11. If therefore maturity were from the Levitical priesthood, you can't mature under law. It would have been impossible. If there hadn't been another priesthood, it would be impossible for any human being to mature from God's point of view. Because the law could mature no one. And that becomes very, very important to us. Now, the record is very limited. I smile because I've been involved with an interesting project I didn't think, I didn't know about until Monday. I found out that on Monday that my heat pump motor died. And this is not the time of year to have your heat die on you quite. And it didn't, I mean, and as a result, I've been doing some, what do I want to say, freezing, maybe is what it is, doing some construction work in my house. I'm still, they didn't get it done on Thursday, and hopefully it gets done pretty quick. So we replaced the heat pump and a little bit more. But this week, it's been kind of fun because I was talking to these two fellows. You know, when that happened, I just stopped and I said, Lord, you're going to take care of this. Let me know who you want me to, whose life I'm going to touch. And there are two Hispanic guys, Adolfo. I don't know whether I want to be strapped by that name, he's a young guy. And I'm trying to remember how he pronounces his name. I don't remember all of a sudden. Anyway, there are two. And the interesting part of it was they walked into my study because I put a new duct into my study. So I'm getting heat blowing in from the top and it should warm my study up a little bit. So they walked in and I happen to have some Hebrew written on my whiteboard. And that was me. I just suddenly can't remember. This is pretty common, but he spells and pronounces it differently. But anyway, this kid says, I can see they're kids, they're probably close to 30. He said, that's Hebrew, isn't it? And I said, yeah, that's Hebrew. And his partner says, how did you know that was Hebrew? You know, and it was my handwritten Hebrew. It wasn't Hebrew text. And so I had an opportunity to talk to, I've had the opportunity for 2 days. To share with them, pray for these guys. One of them is in a charismatic church. The other one, I'm not sure what he's in. It's not charismatic. He was describing his family. Some days they attend a church they are on, from which they're members, because they like the, clapping hands and dancing and noise making in the church. But the church they are in is a little bit more hymn related, although he's on the worship team and plays a guitar. Nice kids, both of them are just. And so I've had the opportunity to really do some talking to them and sharing with them and gave them each a priesthood book. I gave them, okay, you're right. Can I ever let anybody out from under my thumb without giving them an enemy chart? They got three enemy charts apiece. They got two Bible size and two full size and well of God chart and in Christ chart and some of those things. And I had a good chance to talk to them about how important those scriptures are in those things that I've given them. And so I sent them away with a... I thought I sent them away and they didn't get the job all the way done. They came up short some stuff and they have to finish it up. But it was interesting because I talked about a little bit about where I was preaching. And they're on my sermon distribution list now. So they're getting a little bit from me. What I said, thinking I wouldn't see him probably again, was if you're studying the Bible like you should and you're working on it, you have some questions or you're going to be asked to do something like teach or anything, If you want some material, I have it. It's very likely I have what you would want. I have lots of notes that I could give you. And if you want to, give me a call, come by, and I'll give you material, and you'll have plenty to use if you're doing that kind of thing. One of them almost went to a Bible college. It was funny because I knew where it was. I don't know if anybody's heard of Patton Bible College. Patton Bible College is in Oakland. That's why I know it. For years back in the 50s. No, it wasn't 50s. That was back in the 60s. B.B. Patton was a woman preacher in Oakland. And it was Patton Bible College she started. It's funny. Her two daughters, they were twins, came to Western after I had graduated. And I think they got Western Baptist degrees. And then they went on somewhere and got PhDs and were teaching at Patton. So he was going to go to Patton. That has nothing to do with Melchizedek in that matter. But it was interesting. They had never heard of the fact that they were believer priests. That's one reason I gave them the book. I told them how to read it. I said, you have so many privileges that if you understand that, it will make a huge difference in your life. And so we will see. I don't know that I'll ever hear, but it was kind of interesting. Melchizedek was a priest of the Most High God, and we'll work on that next Sunday. And we're going to look at names and titles today in that relationship. And it's all the story goes around Abram, Ham going and slaying kings to rescue Lot and the king of Sodom and Gomorrah, and taking back, plus taking the stuff that these kings that he killed had. And so what happens? What did Abraham get out of his tithe? It didn't cost him anything. So he gave the tithe of the booty. What did Melchizedek do with it? Doesn't say. But you know what Abraham got out of it? He got a blessing. It says that Melchizedek blessed Abraham. And we'll see that. Kind of interesting how little teeny bits of information, and we'll deal with the tithe. Now in verse 1, let's get there so we don't get too lost here. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings, blessed him. Upfront statement. And so here, and it doesn't say it here yet, we're going to get there, that a greater blessed one who was lesser. And so what's going to happen in the context that Levi was in the loins of Abraham when he gave a tithe to Melchizedek. And so a Levi is a lesser person compared to Jesus Christ in his priestly relationship. Melchizedek. This Melchizedek is what it says. The word this happens to be in an emphatic position. He's tying immediately back to, what do we have, six words back where his name is given in chapter 6 and verse 20. And this Melchizedek, and nobody else that we know of, had that name. Some have suggested that was not his name. And in the notes, you do have it, by the way. I put it in Hebrew in the notes so you could see it. Let's see, where did my notes go? They're here. And then the Melchizedek is in Hebrew, and it's over on page 2, and it's under B. And you can see there's a little dash in the middle of it, even though you might not. The dash is not a Hebrew letter. The dash is a connector. It's called a makif. So it's Melchizedek. And we'll talk about it, but then you can kind of see. Some will say it's just a title. We don't know for sure. It's just kind of interesting because there's quite a bit of controversy about one letter there. And that's the jot. If you want to know what a jot is, look at that Melchizedek, and you have that dash that's elevated. To its right is this little, looks like a comma up high. That's a yod. Yod, yot, jot. That's the smallest letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And so that is a controversial letter. We'll talk about it in just a minute. So let's talk about Melchizedek and its occurrences. We have it twice in the Old Testament. We have it in 14:18 of Genesis, and we have it over in Psalm 110:4. That's it. That's the whole thing. You know from Psalm 110:4 that Melchizedek was a priest. But you have to come to Hebrews to know that he was a high priest. And to know when. Because it doesn't say, it just says he was a priest of the Most High God in Genesis. But you are a priest after the order of Melchizedek is a citation from Psalm 110 and verse 4. Then in Hebrews, we have a total of 9 occurrences, and those 9 occurrences involve six of those are in this 7th chapter where Melchizedek is used. Now, you might not know that there's a spelling issue. There is. It's kind of interesting because I have a list I've been tagging out on 14 of Genesis. And how it's spelled in different translations. I put it with a C on the end because that's the way it is in the AV. But most or many translations end it with a K. It's the same. It's just the way they pronounce. I mean, I would, if I was transliterating this into Hebrew, I'd put a Q on the end instead of a K or a C. It's a quof in Hebrews, or Hebrew. So Melchizedek is not a real familiar subject. And they asked me what I was teaching these guys installing this heating stuff for me. And I said, I'm speaking on Melchizedek. One of them knew what I was talking about somewhat. The other one had no idea, never heard of that before. Because, I mean, it's interesting because it was, I mean, it was a great illustration of where we're at. Because that's the way it is in Christianity, a lot of people have never heard of Melchizedek. 11 times in the Bible. But you read the Old Testament enough and you've only got one that's really pertinent because it's in the stories. And then you have one that is prophetic in the Psalms. And so people just don't often understand who Melchizedek really is. And what he's, what's important. And that's one reason I wanted to, do Genesis 14. I was trying to think about it the last time I went through this house and I don't think I've ever preached a straight message out of, Genesis 14. I've taught it many times, but haven't done the message. Okay. Let's break his name out. What does it mean? Melech. You heard milk? Melech is the word king. Melech, it's the normal word for king. And so you will see King David is Melech David. So you see that Melech form. So that's king. Then you have that little yod, that jot, to use the English translation in the New Testament. And that is usually a first person singular pronominal suffix. That means my or I. Now the question is that there or is it just a bridge? There's a lot of discussion And there's a big controversy, it seems, among Hebrew lexicons as to whether it should be my king or whether it should be king of. You don't need something like that to make it what we call a genitive relationship. King of Tzedek. Tzedek is righteousness. Righteousness or righteous. So you could translate, and what we have in the Greek is just a transliteration from the Hebrew. In other words, it took the Hebrew letters and put it in there. And the problem is you have an iota, an I in the middle of it, so they are picking that up, which is, I shouldn't say it's a problem, but they do, and it doesn't really help us any. And so you see him as the King of Righteousness, or identified as King of Righteousness. Again, is that the name he was born with? We don't know. Why? Because verse 3 tells us we don't know. Verse 3 tells us we don't know anything about where he came from. We have no idea where he came from. We have no idea what his pedigree was in any sense. We have no idea what his grandpa's name was, nor his father's name, nor his mother's name. We have no idea. We don't know his birthday. We will see all of that when we get to verse 3 in a couple of weeks if the Lord tarries. And so we know very, very little about this guy, but we have his name. The King of Righteousness. I am inclined to believe that he was born Melchizedek. But that's my inclination. I know that in the Old Testament, often names were given because God gave them those names. And those names were significant. And so, I mean, that's my inclination. Now, when I say it that way, I'm 90% sure, but that doesn't mean anything because I'm me, in that. And so but that's the name that is given here. And it's this Melchizedek going into 620. The next term is Melchizedek is identified as King of Salem. King of Salem. Another Melech. King of Salem. Now, there's a lot of controversy about this thing of King of Salem. Is this Salim, which is a city to the east of Nablus, which is the old site of Samaria, up north of Jerusalem about 50 miles, and then east a few. Because it's Salim. To do it in Hebrew, you have a yod in there. Salem, what does it mean? After last year, you can't say I don't have a lot of fun. I had so much fun in the studies in geography and in Jerusalem. Traditionally, Salem has been identified with the city of Yerushalem, of Jerusalem. There's controversy about that. I am not terribly worried about whether it's the city of Jerusalem, because the Bible tells me exactly what it meant in this matter. Because you will notice at the end of verse 2, it says, after that also, King of Salem, which is King of Peace. Shalom. Shalom Aleichem. If I walked up to you and said Shalom Aleichem, do you have any idea what I am saying? I'm saying peace unto you. And, or I could say Shalom Alecha or Shalom Alech, luck, depending on your gender. But Alechem, You hear it sounds like Arabic. They do the same, a similar thing. Salem, Alakim, in that matter. And so this thing of, it says it's peace. It's a Greek word for peace. And it ties right back. It's Salem, but it's Shalom. It's all the same. You have the three letters of the word that are making this up. So he's a king of peace. That's significant. But what does it mean? What did it mean in Genesis 14? Doesn't say. We don't. We just know it identifies him. It's always interesting how often I've heard people say that when Abram came back after Lot, he went up over the hump of Jerusalem and stopped by there and ran into Melchizedek on the way down to Sodom and Gomorrah. Because he went clear up into Aram, up into Syria, and he came down. And we really don't know how he went and came. He could have gone up on the west plateau of Israel, up into Syria, which takes you up on the west side of the Sea of Galilee, up into the Golan, and into Syria over Mount Carmel. Or he could have gone on the east side. And up the Jordan Valley, got a little rough along there, but he could have gone up depending on where Sodom was. But I think Abram was on the west side in the western plateau. Here I'm talking about this geographic thing that, if you were in that class, you'd have had it all pegged on it. Like I say, I had a blast. So that's the fun of it. I know it's not didache, but I did some didascalia. Yeah, I prefer didache, but it worked out fine. It maybe gratified me as much as it did anybody else in that matter. So he's a king of peace. Of peace. Peace means you are at peace. Shalom is not a word that is presently a popular word for some peoples in the Middle East. I'm trying to get through a book. I'm trying. It's very trying. Some books are not well written from what I want. And this is a book about Beirut, Lebanon, and the American University in Beirut. And it's written from a almost anti-Israeli perspective on it, and blames a lot of the problems in the Middle East on Israel. And I shouldn't read things like that, but I wanted to know this history. The American University in Beirut had its roots in congregational missions. It was a missionary endeavor. It became the most elite university in the Middle East for many, many years. Prime ministers, princes, presidents, bureaucrats, doctors, came out of the American University in Beirut, and they just were a spawning ground for leadership, because the Arab peoples, or the Middle Eastern peoples, did not tend to think abstractly. They learned how to learn by rote, and so when they learned to think for themselves. This guy claims that this whole Arab Spring that was more recent came out of people that had been trained at the American University in Beirut to think independently. And the hatred for Israel came not from the university, but it came from the products of the university who started to think independently and wanted a homeland that they chose to reject earlier. So anyway. But this issue of peace in the Middle East is something else. You have so many people that just would love to shove Israel into the sea. They would just love to do that. It was so unfair in the 67 war when all of the Arab armies and nations and their air forces, including Egypt, which is the most populous country in the Middle East, decided to attack Israel. This little handful of Jews in Israel. They were going to annihilate them. You remember what happened in 67? They came on Yom Kippur a couple weeks ago. No, Yom Kippur was 2 weeks ago yesterday. That's a high holy day. That is the highest Jewish holy day. And so a lot of their troops were commemorating Yom Kippur, and they call it the Yom Kippur War. And Israel trounced them because, well, I have a funny feeling that I know who's taking care of Israel in that matter. And it was very interesting. There's so many stories to be read there. There is no peace in certain sections of Israel. I didn't talk to a lot of Arabs. I talked to a few, probably half a dozen or more when we were over there. I remember standing in front of our hotel and talking to a taxi cab driver and then talking to him. Every problem they had was because of Israel. Yet his taxi is sitting in front of an Israeli hotel in Jerusalem, and he's making his money from people that the Jews are bringing in, and he was making a pretty fair living. And he blamed him and blamed him and blamed him. I don't know whether I would have wanted to take a tour with his uncle or not. He told me, or he offered, he gave me a name and a number and everything else to call his uncle, who would take me personally on a tour of Jordan. And I could go to all the sites in Jordan because this uncle knew his way around. And I was tempted. No, I wanted to go to certain places in Jordan and didn't get there. So Melchizedek, king of peace. There's no peace there. The hatred there is for the wall. Why did Israel build their wall? Did they build it to segregate economically the Palestinians from Israel? No. They built it to keep the terrorists out. They were protecting their own people. And that wall is, I don't think I'd want to live very near that wall. Because it is drab, dark. It would be a symbol of the problems of terrorism. And so what do? They don't throw rocks over the wall. They throw rockets over the or up from Gaza. Haven't done that for a little bit. It's just amazing to me. And I've got to get off that subject in that matter. And so what happens? Abraham meets Melchizedek. He meets him from the slaughter of the kings. The word slaughter in the King James is from the word kapas, which is cutting off, to cut. A derivative of that Greek word is a word for knife. And so slaughter may sound, that's why this section was kind of intriguing to me as a kid, as a guy. I mean, I was, World War II, we had vets in our church. I was ready to go and fight. Then Korea came and all of these issues. I thought, I wasn't sure I wanted to go to Korea. I was too young anyway. But the idea of fighting was something that was pretty important in that day for a lot of kids, a lot of guys. The cutting off or cutting down of these kings, we'll see about it next week. And so at that point in time, at the point of the meeting, Melchizedek gave Abraham a priestly blessing. If you did not have the description that follows this, it wouldn't make a lot of sense. It says he was a priest of the Most High God. He was a priest of the Most High God. Was there a priest for Abraham? Who was the priest that talked to God at the time of Abraham? Who was the one that had a relationship? You're right. Abraham was the head of his family, and he had direct access to God if God let him. So the heads of the families represented the family, and that tells us even more. Because as the family priest, he had to accept a blessing from one who was above him and beyond him, who was a priest of the Most High God. We know that Melchizedek was not Jewish. Abraham wasn't Jewish either. He was a Semite. The Jews came from Abraham. He wasn't an Israelite because Israel was his offspring. And so he was not an Israelite. He was the head of Israel. And thinking through this section and working through it, Israel had the highest esteem for Abraham. They practically worshiped Abraham, though they knew it was prohibited. They knew where the cave of Machpelah was. And so they knew where the remains of, you're right, Abraham, Sarah, Israel. I mean, you have all of those collected in that burial ground that was purchased by Abraham for Sarah. Remember, she was the first one buried there. And that is, again, a place where there's no peace. If you wanted to go and visit the traditional site of Machpelah today, you probably would need to go with an armored car. We talked to our guide when we were over there and said, would there be any way to get there? And just to see that. There's a mosque there now. There have been bloody massacres in Hebron. Hebron, however you want to pronounce it. That's where it is, Hebron. It's not that far from Jerusalem. It's less than 40 miles. And it's Arab, pretty much. But they have killed Jews. They've killed more Jewish old people and kids in the history of Hebron. It's very, very sad, some of the stories that go there. They had a yeshiva in Hebron. Yeshiva is a Jewish school for rabbinical students, Orthodox. And they killed about half the people in that school, but the others managed to escape. So it's not a nice place. But Melchizedek surpasses Abraham in value, though the Jews long to go to the tomb of Abraham. Like I say, they come close to worshiping Abraham. They want to be there. Now, Orthodox Jews are very interesting because they like to spend times in graveyards and not at Halloween. They do that. You go to places. I mean, the traditional tomb of David is not there. They don't know where it is. But they have a site. In fact, you can walk about 30 feet and you're in the room in which the Last Supper was traditionally held. David's tomb and the location of the Last Supper are in the same building, essentially. And to go in there, it's really mystical, religious, superstitious awe. When we were there, there was an Orthodox Jew praying at David's tomb. You have your prayer book, and you have all of your good stuff on, your yarmulke, and, you know, their little box on their head, and their box in their wrists, and their prayer shawls. See, I'm trying to remember what it did. He have it over his head or just on? It's kind of interesting what they did. Worshipping David almost. They're praying there. They would go to pray. They will, this is an aside in Judaism in a sense, if a woman is incapable of having kids, is well known, they go to well-known rabbi's tombs. Some have spent the night on the tomb praying for a child. It's not uncommon. I would not be surprised if that wasn't true in certain parts of New York with the rabbis there, hoping that they, I mean, it's works all the way. But here you have Melchizedek is given a priestly blessing. To Abraham, and Abraham, and the word blessing is to be well spoken of. It's eulogia. It's a priestly blessing. We won't go back and look at more priestly blessings. I did that in Permian a few months ago, where we looked at the priestly blessing, which is very interesting. And so he blesses him. Well, that takes us right down to the end. Here comes Abraham with all of these people. I just wonder how much time is involved. It never tells us how long it was for Abraham to go clear up to Aram and to come back with all of this, these people that have been hauled off by these kings. And when he was hauling these people back, I'm sure he had captives from those kings. He was carrying all the booty they had. He had all of their weapons probably. He had any jewels they had, depends on whether he got where they were. I mean, was that home or not? If it was home, he cleaned out the safety deposit office. Is what would have happened. And so what happens, we get to verse 2. To whom Abraham gave a tenth part of all. Of all. Oh, that must have meant everything Abraham had he gave. No, it's not what it says. It just says all here. What we're going to do next week, I'm going to look at the occurrences of all in Genesis 14. This all is described in this context, and that's one reason I wanted to read down a little further. At the end of verse 4, the all is identified as what? Spoils. So he didn't have to, I mean, it was out of pocket in a sense. You know, he had to pay for his own wear and tear on his vehicles. But you realize from that he paid some of his people. But it didn't cost him anything else. So it's kind of interesting. He gave a tenth of the spoils. Now I ask you, how would you distribute spoils? How did Alexander do that when he conquered a town and a city? How did he distribute spoils? They had to make sure they were, I mean, these are mercenary soldiers he was paying by the spoils. Now what they would do, they would stack them up in a pile or several piles and distribute them according to their previous agreements as to who would get how much, what percentage. Now, if you made a pile of spoils, How would you do it? You just dump everything on top of each other. No, you wouldn't. You would put the more valuable, more fragile kinds of things on the top of the pile. So this 10% may not have been 10% of the quantity, but it would have been, I mean, it would have been 10% of the quantity, but not 10% of the value. It could have been more. If you had the king's crown, which king was it of England? And all of the instability in England, he was going out across the moors, running from the opposition, and he had all the crown jewels in wagons. And the tide came in, and the crown jewels disappeared in the tide. I mean, the wagons were washed away, and so he did not have a crown. And so they decided to crown a king, which was his son, because he died in that event. And they didn't have a crown for him. So they just took a gold band around his head. And he was 9 years old. The other one wouldn't have fit anyway. So it was just kind of interesting, this thing. The value is in the top. He gave 10% of all the spoils. So that becomes important. So he didn't give him $500 bills to put in his wallet. He gave him stuff, as you'd expect. And so he gave him a tenth part of the spoil of the whole thing. One tenth. Now, we have some real interesting answers because God wanted it this way. He's going to tell us more about the names that we've seen in verse 1. And that is, he says, first being interpreted, King of Righteousness. He tells you what Melchizedek means, King of Righteousness. Of righteousness. I wish I could bridge the gap, and I can't because I don't understand it. I need some more verses. You know, my righteousness, your righteousness is because you're in Christ. How does the human nature of Christ's righteousness relate to the order of Melchizedek? We don't know. What is Melchizedek, a prophetic name for the one who became the high priest? We just don't know. We need another verse. And so he's called the King of Righteousness, and then after that, the King of Salem. And then they identify it by the Greek, the King of Peace. King of Peace. The word peace, Irenaeus, is a normal word for peace. That's the same word for the fruit of the Spirit. It's used in a number of different ways, the King of Peace. That tells me what Shalem means, the King of Peace. I don't need to relate it directly to the city of Jerusalem. In Abraham's era, Jerusalem was not known as Yerushalayim. It was better known as Yabus or Jebus. It was a short name. Or what was Jabus in the era of Abraham? It was not up on the Temple Mount when this all happened. Genesis 14 is before Genesis 22. In Genesis 22, what happens? Now, I'm talking tradition here a little bit, but in 22, Abraham had his great, great act of faith. When he believed God, and this old, old duffer went up the mountain with his son and was going to sacrifice his son. He went up there. That was in 22. That was this great act of faith. What was the mountain? It was called Moriah. Many, many believe that Moriah is where the Temple Mount is today. It's not in many ways because it's been chopped down and leveled and all kinds of it. So, what do we have? We have Jerusalem, or what would be called Jebus, is down the hill from the present site of the old city of Jerusalem, and the remains are down the hill to the south and a little bit to the east of the present old city of Jerusalem. And so you're down in the Kidron Valley, and you have, why would they put a city down there? They have a spring, Gihon, which has been running and running and running for centuries. You put a city where the water is. You don't put it where there's not water. You can't sustain a population. Jebus may have been, many think that if you had 100 people that lived in that town in Abraham's era, you were doing well. And it grew. Zion, the city of Zion, extended up beyond that, up toward what's old, the old city today. And it still wasn't the old city of Jerusalem. Zion is outside the walls of the old city. So as we look at this, Melchizedek, still we don't know a lot. I mean, we know some, but we don't know a lot. So next week, what we're going to do, we're going to go popping into chapter 14 of Genesis. We're going to talk a little bit about the backdrop there. I think we can move along with it. It'd be fun to go through in about 4 weeks, but we won't. So you can get some of the idea. And we're going to emphasize that word "the" or "all". All. There's no article in front of any of the occurrences in Genesis. All. And it all ties to the spoil. So Melchizedek, he's an interesting guy. But remember what I read? Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. We have no idea when he was born. I have no idea when he died. You have no idea where he was buried. We have absolutely no idea. And that fits because it's similar to, it's like that of the Son of God. Thank you, Father, for the opportunities of the hour. We trust we've benefited from our time in these two verses. Well, thank you as you continue to direct us in Christ's name. Amen.